Welcome to The Way Home with Laura Smith, the show that brings you wonderful guests, helpful advice, and uplifting stories. The Way Home, live inspired. Here's your host, Laura Smith.
Well, in addition to the uplifting story, sometimes we have the absolute most kind of leave you on the edge of your seat. And this time, a true story. We have an author on today, John Manninger, and he's an award-winning author. He's a former narcotics enforcement agent and a special agent with the Department of Treasury and has been for 40 years. But he writes a very fascinating story. It's called Lethal Doses, the story behind the godfather of fentanyl, who was basically like the Breaking Bad character, and his journey into the world of illicit drugs and how he was caught. It's all coming up next on The Way Home.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Way Home with Laura Smith. Here's Laura.
Well, nothing pleases me more than to be able to bring you guests that really make a difference, who have done so much with their lives, and they are so fascinating and so interesting that people want to write books about them. And this is no exception. Today we have, by the author, Dr. Don Steele, who's been on the program before, we have the Scott Holman story, which is called The Mindset of a Dyslexic Entrepreneur. And Scott Holman is with me now, and I have honestly, it's hard to keep up with all the various things that he has done in his life, accomplished in his life, but he's learned so much and he's sharing a lot of his great wisdom and tips for living with all of us now. Thank you so much, Scott, for being on the show.
My pleasure.
A lot of people have something called dyslexia, and I don't think it was until probably the last several decades or so that it was really even talked about. But you probably grew up in a time where it was not understood, and children of your type were completely misunderstood, misdiagnosed, mistreated, also, as you mentioned in your book, both by fellow students and your teachers and professors. But you came through it all, you learned so much, and you, honestly, you're a Renaissance man of the highest order. I've never seen someone with so many disparate, interesting careers and passions for life, you, between scuba diving and restoring old lighthouses and owning restaurants and being a biologist and so many other things, and a businessman. Do tell us, and a military man, please, let's start. The Mindset of a Dyslexic Entrepreneur. What is the basis of the book and what you want us to get from it?
I think one of the reasons that I decided to have Don Steele persuaded me to do the book. And I think one thing that put me over the top to do it was the fact that if we talked about the 1 in 5 people who have dyslexia and the parents who are dealing with a child that maybe is not diagnosed, but yeah, maybe they are. And so they feel that all is lost, that the child has no future. Which is absolutely not true. If he's dyslexic, he's probably smarter than the teachers he's going to meet along the way.
Aha. Uh-huh. So is this what you would call, or what we would call today, somewhere on the spectrum?
Well, if we can bring attention to universities and legislators and so forth to be able to identify young people who are dyslexic and be able to train them properly. I think there's a gold standard of teaching dyslexic children called the Orton-Gillingham method, which is a multisensory process of teaching young people. Then it'll all be worthwhile. In fact, one of the things I'm going to do with the proceeds of the book is to donate it to Northern Michigan University in Marquette, Michigan, to start a dyslexic education program. And by doing so, we're going to take our professors, and I have complete buy-in by the president, by the provost, and the department heads to do this, and to start a fund that will help educate our professors on teaching our soon-to-be teachers on identifying suspected dyslexic children, and how to educate and teach dyslexic children. And so if that's something we can accomplish with this book, I'll be happy.
Well, that is wonderful. So there's even more of a reason to pick it up and buy it, thinking of what that can do for future generations. Scott, for those of us who don't really know exactly what dyslexia is and how it affects the person who has it and their learning, what are the things that you have learned over all these years that would have been helpful to you that were not available at the time that you were in school?
Well, first of all, it's not a learning disability. It is that we learn differently.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Okay? And with 1 in 5 students having probable dyslexia, that requires some attention on the part of the teachers. And in my growing up, the teachers that I interacted with in front of the class would simply call you stupid or dumb. And, of course, that didn't do too much for your self-esteem or your self-confidence. And it certainly, if somebody was going to be a bully, that gave them the license to do something like that.
So when you have teachers not only modeling terrible behavior by name-calling you and labeling you stupid, like you said, invitations then to children to do the same. I can't even imagine what that must have been like. It must have been a horrible experience. How did you get through getting up and going to school every day? Back then, I don't know how old you are exactly, but then, as you said, you know, people didn't really have a grasp on it, didn't understand what it was. How were you able to get through that? Did you go home and tell your parents what you were experiencing, or did they understand that you had a different way of learning, or was it something they also had to be educated about?
No, they didn't understand why I couldn't read or couldn't write. They would try to get a tutor for me, which really doesn't work because they didn't know the Orton-Gillingham method of teaching. And that's the problem with someone who says, well, he has a learning disability, so we'll put him in special ed.
Mm.
Special ed doesn't have the knowledge or the capability of using the gold standard of teaching dyslexic children, the Orton-Gillingham method. And so until we get that widespread knowledge out, there's going to be a lot of children that are going to get left behind while they're in early education.
Right. And, you know, what I was told, and just, you know, the most basic of levels of what dyslexia was, it's you see letters and phrases and somehow backwards or something. I mean, that was really the extent. I didn't really learn what it was. I didn't have this situation myself. My daughter didn't have it. So I really didn't learn what that meant. What exactly is the mechanism? How you see things, which makes it complicated to be able to read regularly.
I think one of the things that that I've read that is interesting is that back in the 1800s in Europe, this condition was called word blindness. So it was later into the early 1900s, where in America we gave it another name, and that was dyslexia. And so I write this in the book. My second grade experience was that I was given a book and told to get in front of the class and read a couple of pages out of the book. I looked at this book, and all I could see was ink on a page that made no sense. Right? I couldn't make out any words. I couldn't understand at all what was on that page. The second grade teacher, not a nice person, started screaming at me and calling me stupid in front of the class. And finally comes to the front of the room, grabs me by the back of my shirt, pulls me off my feet, out into the hallway down to first grade, puts me into a seat in first grade, tells the teacher in front of that class, this kid's too dumb to be in second grade. He belongs here.
Oh.
That first grade teacher was horrified. I think she called my mother at home and told her to come and pick me up.
How awful.
The superintendent at the time, my mother wanted her fired, of course. The superintendent just simply said, well, we can't fire her. There were reasons which I won't go into here, but that is too bad, because how many more people did she wreck the life of along the way?
Terrible, terrible. I mean, and it's still going on today. You can't fire horrible teachers. Something needs to be changed. I just want to remind people who I'm speaking with, Scott Holman, and he has this book called The Mindset of a Dyslexic Entrepreneur, and it's the Scott Holman story. And it's fascinating, because we're focusing now on the early part of your life, where you were raised and growing into a young adult, but dyslexic the entire time, but never having been diagnosed. So finding ways to learn how to learn, and then eventually getting into college. So is that how you got through college as well? So were you still unaware when you were in college that you were dyslexic?
I was aware of what my inabilities were, but I never heard the word dyslexic ever used, or didn't know anything about it. But I knew that I wasn't able to read, and I knew that if I had to write something out in longhand, I was done for. but I was very luck plays a big role in your life very often. And so as I graduated from high school, I didn't have the grades to get into college, but the president of the university, Northern Michigan University, Ed Hardin at the time, had a policy of right to try. So he wanted anybody who really wanted to go to college a chance to get into college and give it a try and see if they could do it. Now, I suppose another way of looking at it is you were admitted on probation, right? And so, again, using my tape recorder and my electric typewriter, I was able to squeak by on some of these classes that I needed to pass and get passing grades.
And you were a biology major, and what was the other major?
Marketing and management.
Yeah, very very different. You know, it seems like marketing is like the creative side, and then biology is biology.
I was advised by a friend of my father's. He said, you're in one little business after another. He said, why are you majoring in biology when you should be majoring in business? And that was halfway through my college experience. And so I talked to a counselor. I was able to get into the school of business and actually did pretty well in the school of business. And I was just fortunate that opportunity was given to me.
And so business felt like home. It married all of your desires and gifts and talents and such. You did that, and yet when you got out, your story is so fascinating. The different things that you've gravitated towards, the things that you've accomplished, things that you're interested in. Give us some insight into what some of them are, because I think it's an incredible journey. You went in many, many different directions, and all of them fascinating, quite honestly.
And one thing that you're doing enhances what you're doing in another thing. I mean, you learn from those past endeavors and past experiences and apply them to the latest thing that you're in. So when I graduated from college, I wound up going with the Upjohn Company, which is a very well-known, very respectable pharmaceutical company from Michigan. My other endeavors, of course, were starting this scuba diving business, in which I quickly learned that I wasn't going to sell much diving equipment if I didn't have people who knew how to dive. So I learned to, I actually wrote my own instruction manual, doing some research from things I was able to get from Scripps Institute and from and from the Woods Hole Institute in Massachusetts. So along the way, I've always had, and sometimes as you get older, you're more interested in history. But I've always had an interest in history. And so I've restored, I bought a lighthouse based on hearing a radio program on the way to work one morning that this Granite Island was going to be disposed of by the Coast Guard. And I said, well, I know that island. I said, I've taken my scuba diving students out to the island to dive around. And the lighthouse was in really bad shape then. And that was many years ago. So I looked into it when I got back and I submitted a bid. Well, the interesting thing was that this story came out of the Free Press in Detroit. And I had asked the office in Massachusetts when we would know if we were successful. She said, well, we have a lot of bids to open. And she said, better contact us tomorrow to see. Well, in the meantime, the Detroit Free Press was following this. They called my home. My wife answers the phone and they said, congratulations on buying the lighthouse. And she said, he bought a what?
She's probably used to these kinds of things
I should have told her that I was bidding on a lighthouse.
Yeah, you were bidding on a lighthouse. Oh my goodness. I hate to stop you because it's fascinating. I mean, the journey and through all these different things. And I know you even have, like I said before, a restaurant to add in there, but we only have 2 minutes left of the program. My guest is Scott Holman, and the book is The Mindset of a Dyslexic Entrepreneur, The Scott Holman Story. This man has truly, I mean, with what, you know, the way he was brought up in those schools that had no idea whatsoever how his learning abilities were different from others and would end up netting him such a fascinating life, a life of such great success and interesting. You know, you really wonder. And in the final minute here, what would you like to say to the audience? Maybe somebody who has a child that's dyslexic, maybe they are themselves, or just your greatest tip for living a fascinating and very satisfying life. What would you say?
I would say, read the book, take some solace in the fact that all is not lost, that even though there's problems in early ed and it's a difficult time for the child, at the end of the journey, and once you're out in the real world, you'll find that dyslexia is actually a gift, and the way that you think and solve problems is different than other people. There are executives that will recruit and hire dyslexics because they think out of the box, they think differently, and they solve problems differently. And so my message to parents of dyslexic children is really all is not lost. It may turn out to be a very positive thing at the end of the day.
Yes, indeed. And again, Scott has offered to give some of the proceeds of the book to a university in Michigan that is going to help teach future professors and teachers on how to identify dyslexia in some of their students, and then also the methodology to working with them so that they can learn at the best of their ability. The book is called The Mindset of a Dyslexic Entrepreneur, The Scott Holman Story. The author is Dr. Don Steele. You'll find it anywhere on Amazon or wherever fine books are sold. And again, proceeds going towards this wonderful cause of teaching future, so that no student has to go through again what Scott Holman had to as a child.
But for a student that flunked second grade and at 82 got his honorary doctorate of business degree, has some satisfaction.
That's right. You got your degree. That's right. In your 82nd year.
Yeah. Took a while.
But worth it. Oh, my goodness. Scott Holman, you really are something and a great, great inspiration. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Again, the book is The Mindset of a Dyslexic Entrepreneur, the Scott Holman story. And you are living proof of all of that. And then some. Thank you so much for joining us on the way home today. We greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Way Home with Laura Smith. Here's Laura.
Well, I never had a chance to watch the show Breaking Bad, but my daughter and a billion other people on the planet Earth did, and they were so fascinated by this character and the whole topic matter, and starting out with really great talent, but then turning it to something unfortunately nefarious for the world. And we're living right now in what is an absolute crisis, and that is one of fentanyl poisoning, which is happening by the hundreds of thousands now, I think even a year, but we'll get all the facts on it correctly. I have an author with me who's written a book that has shot up to number one on Amazon. It's also been made into a Fox Nation episodic series. And rightly so, it sounds absolutely compelling, has so much firsthand experience with it. John Maniger is an award-winning author. He's a former undercover agent and narcotics enforcement agent, and he's also a special agent with the U.S. Treasury, or was, I should say, and he's writing these books that are hitting him out of the park, but this one especially hitting a note right now with the United States of America and the world, all about fentanyl. It's called Lethal Doses, the story behind the godfather of fentanyl. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much, John, for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, did you know you were going to write the book about it that was going to turn out to be something that was going to be absolutely so front and center at this time in the world, in history?
Well, yeah, because I first met the subject of the book, a guy by the name of George Eric Marquardt. Everybody called him Squeak. I first met him in 1976 when I was working as a narcotics agent in Oklahoma. And I recognized at the time that he was just a really unique character, somebody that was a very dangerous individual, but very, he was just a fascinating character. And later on, when I learned that he was the person who first brought fentanyl, put fentanyl out on the streets in the United States, I thought this needs to be a book at some point. And after about 15 years of back and forth with Squeak and talking to all of the people that were part of that story, I was able to put the book together and get it out.
So that was, you said, in the 1970s.
Yeah, I met him in 1976 when I was an agent. I was working undercover for OBN and Bureau of Narcotics was using him as an informant. He was an informant and telling us about clandestine laboratory operations in Oklahoma. And I was working with him at the time until he did what he did best, which was take off and start setting up clandestine laboratories, doing it himself. He was a genius. His self-taught. He never graduated from high school. He was a completely self-made chemist, and he was recognized by the various people that dealt with him as somebody that had real talent, real ability in the scientific arena. He was able to do synthesis and work with chemicals that nobody else could do. And you mentioned Breaking Bad earlier. That's a good story about clandestine chemistry and somebody who's very smart and turns his talents to the dark side. Well, that's exactly what Squeak did. He did that all his life. He didn't wait until he was 55 like Walter White did. He broke bad when he was age 12 and never looked back.
Wow. Age 12. So you said he dropped out of high school, but he knew how to do this. Now, how is it that he became an informant? Had he already started making some of the more nefarious drugs? I know that he was also responsible for AZT, which was one of the only things that was kind of helping to cure AIDS at the time. I'm trying to remember when it came out, but
yeah, it came out in the
The 90s or
in the 80s, yeah.
Or 80s, okay.
Well, he became an informant for OBN when he got busted for stealing some lab equipment in Oklahoma City. And by that time, he was already a convicted felon, and he'd been convicted in Wisconsin and Michigan and Indiana and several other locations, including Oklahoma. So he was looking at some real time, and he needed a favor from the Bureau of Narcotics, and he contacted them and said, I know where there's a guy making crystal methamphetamine, which is what he was making at the time himself. And he put us onto the laboratory in Oklahoma City and testified against the guy later on. And then he was working with me on an undercover project at that time. But that was his whole life, was going between doing crime. I mean, he never had a legitimate job. He never, when he retired, when he got released from prison the last time, he didn't even bother applying for Social Security because he'd never worked enough quarters to qualify. And his whole life was crime. And he did that until the point where he got involved with fentanyl, looking at fentanyl in the late 80s and early 90s. And was put away basically for good at that point.
You said in the late 80s. So fentanyl for most of us has only been in the news for the last, I would say, 4 or 5 years. Then they started counting the amount of deaths from it. They were originally calling it overdoses from it, but then people who had children die from it are like, no, you don't understand. My kid was not a drug addict. He was given one pill that was dressed as a like oxycodone, you know, when he was in the ninth grade, and it had fentanyl in it. And that was it. It was a one stop, you know, death sentence. And so they said, it's poisoning. It's not an overdose situation. But there are people who do get addicted to it, I believe, and that they are able to somehow kind of just go through the day to day, getting high, coming down, then getting high again. So fentanyl, you said back in the 80s. So did he create the substance that we now know as fentanyl, or the chemical compound?
No, fentanyl itself was first developed by a Belgian company, a guy by the name of Paul Janssen, and he was he ran his company, Janssen Pharmaceutical, was the manufacturer, the first maker of fentanyl. It was originally made in the late 1959, 1960, and it was marketed as an anesthetic, a general anesthetic. So it was only used very sparingly in tightly controlled conditions, and for about 20 years, actually. There was very little fentanyl out on the street. There was very little of the drug being diverted, and none of it was being manufactured clandestinely. Squeak got into it because he was locked up in federal penitentiary with a bunch of drug traffickers from mafia guys from New York, and they were interested in finding a substitute for heroin. And so he kind of got interested in this, and it could be a substitute for, could be, it could easily substitute for heroin, and that's what it does today. But it was, it's extremely potent, as you were saying. It is lethal in very small doses, and it has to be carefully handled, and it was beyond the capability of most drug traffickers and clandestine chemists to be able to make it and make it safely. What he did that was different was he developed a sort of shortcut that took a lot of the difficulty out of the process and made it easier to make and cheaper to make and put it out on the street in quantity. So that's what we have today, the situation we have today. But back in 1990, 91, 92, 93, he was the only fentanyl manufacturer in the United States. He and his organization were the only people that were putting it out there. Today, it's coming from China and Mexico and foreign sources, not so much in the United States. and it's everywhere. And like you say, it's a real game changer because you can be seeking another drug and get fentanyl without knowing it. And that's what's happened to a lot of these people that have been poisoned, really. They weren't seeking fentanyl. They weren't trying to get fentanyl for a habit or whatever. They just wanted a pill, and they were made. It was being made in a counterfeit Vicodin or counterfeit oxycodone or something like that, and they don't have any tolerance for it, and it just kills them. Mm-hmm. So I think fentanyl is the big problem that we're going to face in terms of drugs for quite a while. You mentioned that there were people that are able to take it and that do take it for long periods of time. But a lot of those people overdose or take, a lethal dose of it, and they die, and they're revived by Narcan. The only thing that saves so many of these people is this Narcan antidote for opiate poisoning. And if it wasn't for Narcan, there wouldn't be any junkies left. There wouldn't be any of those fentanyl abusers left. They'd all be dead by now. Some of the hospitals say they see the same addict take twice a day, and they're getting Narcan twice a day. So, and it's available over the counter these days. You can get Narcan off the internet, and that's the only thing that's keeping these people alive.
I know, and sadly, I've heard that even in some states that some of the governors and programs are offering it. Narcan is just part of what they call, their drug war against drug is really, feeding them what they need and also giving them the Narcan to keep them alive. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I'm hearing.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely keeping them alive. If it wasn't for Narcan, the death toll would have been much, much higher previously, just because they'd all be dead. They wouldn't be able to revive them, and they'd just be dead. And you don't have repeat customers when they're all deceased. But yeah, it's I bought a thing in Narcan on the internet just to see if it was available, and it is. You can buy it off the internet. You can get it.
Yeah, probably relatively cheap. My guest is John Manninger. He is an author, but he was also, as you can tell from his extensive knowledge, he was a former undercover agent in the narcotics divisions, and he was a special agent at the Department of Treasury. You also worked in money laundering. You were an expert in that, apparently, as well. So you really, cut your teeth on all this stuff that you've been doing it for decades, and yet here we are, 2025, and it seems like all of this stuff, nothing has been mitigated. It's exacerbated in our society these days. I mean, what do you think of the current state of affairs of all of this between the fentanyl? I mean, are we going to see anything, do you think, in the next few years that might bring, the sales of fentanyl and the smuggling of it? Do you feel like maybe there's a possibility that the new administration is going to find some ways to get it off the streets, to get it? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, very instructive that in getting back to Marquardt's case, Squeak's case, when he was busted in 1993, February of 93, DEA got him in Wichita, Kansas, and they busted him. That was the only lab in America. And there was, up until that point, there were the fentanyl dose. If you looked at the overdose statistics, it was going up every year for the early 90s, in the early 90s, and then it dropped off to nothing after they busted Squeak. That never happens in the narcotics business. There's always somebody that comes in and takes over immediately, but that didn't happen with fentanyl. That there was no fentanyl lab again seized in the United States until the year 2000, and that guy hadn't been able to get his dope out on the street yet. And then the next lab that the DEA seized was in 2005 in Mexico, and that sort of was the takeoff of the fentanyl that we're seeing now. Then you started to see the fentanyl ramping up, and now it's all coming from the precursor chemicals are being made in China and India for the most part, and shipped to Mexico, and then Mexico is, and some to Canada and the United States, but mostly to Mexico, and then it's made into fentanyl and put in these. I don't know how to stop that. I don't know how that they can stop that. They're talking about, and they should impose sanctions on the companies and the countries that are manufacturing the precursor chemicals, because that's sort of the source, and those that's going to be difficult, because like in China, there's I think 25,000 chemical companies making manufacturing chemicals. In India, there's 80,000. So how can you tap that, or can you get into that to be able to stop it, to turn off this bigot? Very difficult problem. I think that the Mexicans in particular, Mexican government in particular, and the Chinese government, both of them could be much more helpful if they wanted to be. I don't think that they've wanted to be up until now, but I think Trump, if he's really serious about this, he can put pressure on those countries to do the right thing and to shut those sources down. Mm-hmm. I'm not optimistic that that's going to stop it, but I think that this year is the first year that fentanyl overdoses have gone down. Fentanyl poisoning deaths, or whatever you want to call them, have gone down. Mm-hmm. So I mean, there is some reason for optimism, but a very difficult problem to solve.
Right. Yeah. And I know that President Trump was talking about sanctioning the countries that are responsible for the fabrication of most of it. And then also saying that the death rate is actually much higher than it is being reported. He believes it's somewhere around 300,000 as opposed to the 100,000 we've been hearing for the last couple of years. But I don't know whether that's true. Your story, Lethal Doses, the story behind the godfather of fentanyl, this character goes by the name of Squeak, is he still alive and is he still in jail or is he out? And at what point, so he just kept getting reoffending and going back in and reoffending and coming back into jail. Was he did that for most of his adult life?
Oh yeah, he was a career criminal from age 12, and he started making drugs clandestinely when he was 14. He was making heroin for his family doctor, who was an addict, and then in the 60s he was making LSD. He made LSD for the Grateful Dead and Janis Joplin. He made for Timothy Leary. He made a batch of LSD for Timothy Leary. He got put in prison, let out, immediately went back to it. That was part of his uniqueness, was that he was very upfront with everybody. He said, well, as soon as I get out of prison, I'm going to go right back to doing what I'm doing and, making drugs. And that's what I do. And he would tell that to his sentencing judge in our case here in Oklahoma in 1978. But he was, after DEA busted him on the fentanyl lab in Wichita in 93, he got a 25-year sentence, and he did 22 years of that. He was released in 2015, and then he passed away of cancer in 2017, undoubtedly from all of the exposure to all of the chemicals that he'd been dealing with over the years.
And how old was he when he passed away?
He was 73. So
wow.
He spent half of his life in prison.
Yeah, but it doesn't sound like any remorse, and just, kind of, how does somebody like that, who ends up being responsible for so many deaths, get 22 years? I mean, it doesn't seem, whereas you see that other drug runners and stuff like that are now getting more, but how does somebody who actually creates it and distributes it, how is it that are the rules and the laws, are they more stringent now, do you think, or not so much? They are?
Yeah, they were. I mean, it was pretty slack. When we busted him in a meth lab in 1978 here in Oklahoma, he got 10 years for that, and the maximum penalty was 5 years, but we had two counts, and the judge, because he told the judge in court before he got sentenced that I'm going to go right back to doing this when I get out of prison, the judge ran the sentences back to back, and he got 10 years. Today, he would easily have gotten 20, and probably he would have gotten 40 because the penalties have gone up and he's gotten mm-hmm. a lot higher since. And now you can get the death penalty for if it's shown that your product killed somebody, which there's no doubt his did. DEA estimated the deaths they knew about from his fentanyl was 126. And they're pretty sure it was at least 300. I asked him about it, and he said he thought it was at least 1,000. He had no remorse. He never expressed any regrets or remorse for any of this. And he said, I asked him about this in 1978. I said, how can you do this? How do you justify this to yourself? And he said, they pay their nickel and they take their chances just like I do. And I know the consequences of my actions and I accept responsibility for them. And everybody else should do the same. That's not the kind of philosophy that, you know, a civilized society needs to survive.
Did he ever act as though he had remorse? Did he have any sort of any empathy for people who lost their lives by taking something that he created, or no?
No, not at all.
What was the family that he came? What kind of a family did he come from?
A traditional Midwestern family. He was born in Waukesha, Wisconsin. His father worked. His mother stayed home. They didn't have any way to really cope with his. And he was really an intelligent person, very intelligent guy, genius, and I would say a genius in his field. His parents were, he was an only child for about 12 years, and then he got a couple of sisters, little sisters. But at that point, he had already turned to the dark side and gone, you know, broke bad, basically. And he left his, after his first arrest, he left his family. He never saw him again.
Wow. And then, but yet, as we mentioned before, and it's in your book, he did create the compound known as AZT, which went on to apparently help a lot of AIDS people that were dealing with AIDS back in the day, and some of them, you know, completely recovered to a certain extent. So was he being asked by the government to, you know, hey, we'll help you, we'll let you stay out if you can turn your genius towards helping society? Or was that a fluke that he came across AZT? Like, how did that happen?
Well, how that happened was that he got out of Lewisburg, got a federal penitentiary at Lewisburg, and he was looking for some opportunities, came back to Oklahoma, and he was looking for some opportunities that didn't involve making methamphetamine, because he knew that the Bureau of Narcotics was all over that. And so he saw a segment on television where they were talking about AZT being the only thing that was available at the time to treat AIDS, and people were dying from it. And he, at the time, and it wouldn't be today, but at the time, it was the most expensive pharmaceutical that had ever been marketed. And Burroughs Wellcome was making a ton of money on it. And so he said, well, I can do that. And then, just to give you an idea of how extensive his talent was, he did it by getting a sample of AZT and running it through a mass spectrometer, which he was very capable of working with, and breaking it out to all of the components of the drug, and then recreated it, AZT, from the sample. So it was a pretty amazing accomplishment, really. And when he was arrested in 1993, he And he was doing this for the money. He was just doing this. He was just interested in the money, making he could sell it to the AIDS patients for less than the pharmaceutical company was asking. And that's why he did it. But in 93, he was already looking at another drug called Taxol. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it was a cancer drug developed for mostly for breast cancer and very effective. And they were looking for a total synthesis of this. They were able to trying to figure out how we can make this in the laboratory. It's an alkaloid, and it comes from a biological source, comes from a tree. And he was working on that, and he almost got it before he got arrested. And somebody did get it after he had been incarcerated. But that's the kind of ability that he had, and it was an intuitive thing with him. He was able to... He told me and other people that he was able to see the inside of the molecule from the middle of it, and he could look at it and see where all of the atoms were on the molecule, and he could figure from that where he could alter it or change it or whatever. And that's the thing with fentanyl, is that it's a compound that interested him because it's a compound that has almost an infinite number of varieties that if you take one part of the molecule off and put it here and put it over there, it becomes something else, more powerful, less powerful. There's some fentanyl analogs or compounds that are 10,000 times more powerful than morphine. So it's potentially extremely lethal, but it was very interesting for him. And that's one of the reasons that he did it, was that it was interesting.
A mad scientist, a genius, no doubt. Yeah. The book is called Lethal Doses, The Story Behind the Godfather of Fentanyl. And John Maniger, you have other books as well that sound equally as fascinating and interesting. But this one was actually turned into a docuseries on Fox Nation. And they're doing a lot of great episodics now and documentaries, I know, on Fox Nation. And so they picked Lethal Doses. They call it The Story Behind the Godfather of Fentanyl. So people can watch. I believe it's narrated by John Roberts or...
Right.
Yes. And so that's quite extraordinary for you, someone who grew up in Honolulu, Hawaii, and apparently a very good golfer as well.
Well, I watch golf at the professional level, right?
I love that. Well, Amazon has got you in their 100 Hall of Fame, top 100 Hall of Fame reviewer, and a lot of people really finding your book absolutely fascinating as it is. And so people can find it on Amazon and anywhere. And boy, we look forward to hearing from you again. I'm sure you've got more where that came from, where Lethal Doses came from.
Well, I'm sure I do.
Well, you sound like a fascinating guy. Thank you, by the way, for all your service to the United States. It sounds like for many, many decades, you were on the side of right and in the side of good and did a lot for our country. Thank you so much. And for people to also who want to find you, they can go to your website, which is basically your name.com, which is John Maniger, which is spelled MADINGER, johnmaniger.com.
And, Godfather of Fentanyl.com. I got that one too.
Oh, you've got them all. Godfather of Fentanyl. There you go. Thank you so very much. And I appreciate it. Please come back again.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Way Home with Laura Smith. Here's Laura.
Well, we need some upliftment. Jim Cleefield is my guru of good news. He goes out on the interweb of life and finds really fabulous true stories that make you feel better. Hi, Jim. What do you have?
Well, we're going to go to a place that's not too far from your area out of Michiana. Actually, it's North Park, Chicago, as a matter of fact. I think you might be familiar with that. Lynn Shockey, she lives in a senior housing unit in that area of the city. And she went to a recent grocery store shopping trip and bought some groceries. I think the bill came out to about $200. And unfortunately, she had a little issue here in paying for that. Well, she took out her U-card, and unfortunately, it did not work. Well, you figure, okay, she's got some cash, right? She pulled out some money, like bill by bill, to see if she can pay the bill. She was short. Way short of $200. What to do, right? Well, she figured, well, let's see. Should I take this item out? Should I take that item out? Well, all of a sudden, a random act of kindness, a miraculous thing happened. A gentleman, we don't know who his name is. I think he's 102 years old. He's a very old gentleman. Two kids with him. You know what he did? Out of nowhere, he just randomly, without saying a word to her, just simply paid off the balance. And she was so thankful to him. And I think this thing eventually went viral on social media. A lot of people were getting word about this. And she said, I hope someday I get to meet this guy, whoever he is, because I'm so grateful, because she just didn't have enough cash. The car just didn't work. And she needed certain things that she had to eat. So you know what she did? She is paying it forward at her own senior residence by cooking food for her fellow seniors. She said, I'm going to do something special for them. She just was really inspired to do that. I mean, not only this is a heartwarming thing, but inspired her to do something. And eventually, word got around on social to encourage others to do the same thing. These little acts of kindness, a random act like that, because you never know where you're going to find it. And I'll tell you, in our world today, we need this more than ever, LJ. And I just love hearing stories like this because it just makes you really feel good. And for this woman here, the fact that, you know, just somebody simply paying a bill and then paying it forward and doing good for others, that's something really that certainly warms my heart. And I know it warms your heart, too.
Absolutely. Yes, that's a wonderful way to pay it forward that she was able to do. But how lovely of that man. 102. My goodness.
Yeah, it's like that.
And still out there doing good deeds.
He is. God bless you.
Beautiful stuff there. Well, on that note, I'm getting hungry. So it's time to say so long for now. But thank you so much for joining us this week and every week on the way home. As I mentioned, it's we're heading up towards 300 shows at this point and loving every minute of it. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to Bob Small, my producer, and Jim Cleefield, the guru of good news. We'll see you next time on The Way Home. I'm Laura Smith.